afternoon. Today is Monday, August 15th, 2011, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good afternoon. It is 5:03 on August 15th. I'm Martin Lemlin. It's time for a full hour of independent news. Today we're going to have an interview with Michelle Mungall, who is the NDP critic for the education minister. We're also going to have the weekday weather forecast, but as always, we're going to start it off with headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Libyan opposition fighters say they have all but secured a key city in their move toward Tripoli, but gunfire continues. Rebels say that a small force loyal to ruler Colonel Muammar Gaddafi remains in the center of Zawiya, a coastal town just outside of the capital.
The situation will be fine, but yes, there is still bombardment. Gaddafi's men are still in Martyrs Square, and he has maybe 100 to 150 snipers.
Zawiya is along a major supply route between Tunisia and Tripoli. Gaddafi's primary oil refinery is there. There are also reports of intense fights to the east in Brega, where rebels hope to take control of an oil terminal. And Libya's interior minister arrived with his family in Cairo today, ostensibly on vacation, but widely thought to be in defection. Syrian government naval ships continued shelling the port city of Latakia today. Dozens are dead since Saturday, and thousands of Palestinian refugees fled their camp in the city today. Jackson Allers has more from Beirut.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency estimates that more than 5,000 Palestinian refugees have fled their camp in the port of Latakia since this morning. At least 30 people have died in the last 3 days of crackdowns against anti-government protesters. The shelling is the first time Syria has used the Navy in the five-month assault. Syrian state TV denied any shelling occurred and claims they are responding to an Islamist uprising and against armed gangs that have killed some 500 military personnel. Human rights groups say that at least 2,000 people have died since March, but a near-total media blackout prevents confirmation of the facts on the ground. The UN is asking to be granted immediate access to the fleeing Palestinian refugees. Meanwhile, eyewitnesses have reported continued government offensives in the towns of Homs, Hama, Damascus, and Deir al-Zor in the east. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut.
In Iraq today, widespread bombings killed as many as 75 people in a dozen cities. All told, almost 40 attacks were reported. The death toll from a single incident was highest in Kut, where attacks on the town's market killed 35 people. Kurdistan was the only region spared. So far, no one has claimed responsibility. Hacktivists shut down the website of the San Francisco Bay Area Rapid Transit Agency for several hours on Sunday and published customer information. As Andrew Stelzer reports, the hack and a protest planned for tonight are the latest in a series of actions stemming from the shooting death of a passenger by transit police in early July.
Police shot and killed Charles Hill on July 3rd. Reportedly, he was threatening officers with a knife. 1 week later, protests upset about the killing spread to restrictions and caused delays on that evening's commute. In anticipation of another protest last Thursday, BART, the area's rapid transit agency, shut down all cell phone service in targeted stations in an effort to prevent protesters from organizing and communicating. The cell service shut down an act of censorship, and in retaliation, the hacker group Anonymous stole customer information from 2,000 people from mybart.org and published those people's names, phone numbers, and passwords on another website. Several videos explaining the
area rapid transit has decided that blocking cellular communication is the correct way to scare off protesters. To the Bay Area Rapid Transit, by performing this action, you have not only threatened your citizens' safety, but you have also performed an act of censorship. By doing this, you have angered Anonymous. To the people of...
Despite comparisons to dictators in Egypt and Libya, where phone and online communications were shut down to try and quell protests, BART says they may again shut down service tonight. Andrew Stelzer, FSRN, Oakland.
Another campesino from the Rigores community in Honduras was killed yesterday. According to Annie Bird, the co-director of Rights Action, 17-year-old Javier Melgar was shot by security forces for the Empresa Palmera Panama, a palm plantation. Melgar was among a group of indigenous Hondurans who had occupied the farm. In June, the community was burned by local authorities. More than 100 families lost their homes, schools, and places of worship. Campesino groups have long fought to retain rights to their land, a battle that escalated after the 2009 coup. And Haitians continue to die from cholera, some 10 people each day. 6,000. These official numbers do not include those who die in remote areas and whose deaths are not reported. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
The Republican presidential race gained a new face over the weekend after Texas Governor Rick Perry officially announced his campaign for nomination. Meanwhile, Minnesota Representative Michelle Buckman placed first in the Ames straw poll in Iowa, while former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty dropped out of the race after placing third. FSRN's Michael Lawson has more.
Although the Ames straw poll only has a 40% accuracy rate since 1979, the media has traditionally given it a lot of coverage as a major step in the quest for the Republican nomination. Michelle Bachmann narrowly defeated Ron Paul, and despite criticism of her extreme views, including being anti-gay, she expressed optimism on NBC's Meet the Press that her positions could win in a general election.
Most Democrats are reasonable, fair-minded people, and so I have a message that reaches out to them because they, after all, they want jobs too, and they want the economy to turn around too.
Some analysts say Bachmann's popularity is an indication that some voters may share her extreme positions. Judd Legum is vice president of New Media with the Center for American Progress.
Her popularity reflects at least a strain within the Republican primary electorate who really wants these unbending, fairly radical positions out of their candidate.
Coming in a close second in the straw poll was Texas Congressmember Ron Paul, who stands out from the Republican field for his fierce libertarian and anti-war views. Paul is known for his raucous supporters and ideas such as returning to the gold standard. Kyle Condick of the University of Virginia's Center on Politics says while Paul is not electable, his campaigns for president have served more as a vehicle for his ideas.
Over time, you know, whether you like his ideas or not, he's been able to introduce them more into the mainstream. And so, you know, is he going to be the Republican presidential nominee? No, I don't think so. But if you just look at it as his sort of campaign of ideas, I do think that he has gotten some traction on some things.
Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty announced he was leaving the race after coming in third. Texas Governor Rick Perry, who announced his campaign Saturday, took a trip to Iowa this weekend, too. His social conservatism and Christian fundamentalism is expected to cut into Bachmann's support. Some are looking to see how the two will differ on the economy. Speaking at the RedState.com conference in South Carolina, Perry blamed the nation's recent credit downgrade on the president's policy while touting his own record on job creation, dubbed the Texas Miracle.
The fact is, for nearly 3 years, President Obama has been downgrading American jobs. He's been downgrading our standing in the world. He's been downgrading our financial stability. He's been downgrading our confidence and downgrading the hope for a better future for our children.
A New York Times opinion piece by Paul Krugman Sunday criticized the miracle, citing nearly 10% of the state's population is paid the minimum wage, above the national average, keeping wages low to attract corporations. The state has also benefited from massive undocumented immigration and general population growth. Additionally, recent census data reveals Texas has the highest percentage of citizens without health insurance. Legum says the views of Perry and Bachman on entitlements may be important if either is to emerge as the nominee.
Perry has said in the past that he believes Social Security is unconstitutional. Bachman's calling for very extensive cuts in Medicare, even beyond where Paul Ryan was. And I think that that could be, if one of them emerges, that could be a real liability.
Frontrunner Mitt Romney chose not to seriously compete in Iowa after a disappointing showing in 2007. The next Republican presidential debate will take place on September 7th. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
It began in Toronto and has spread to 30 US cities and dozens of countries around the world. This weekend, the Slut Walk movement came to the nation's capital. Like the marches in other cities, the DC Slut Walk was a response to a culture that blames the victims of sexual assault. But the location gave it a political focus, as marchers called on Congress to pass laws promoting equality for women and LGBT people. Alice Olstein reports.
Hundreds of marchers gathered in front of the White House Saturday to send a message to the president and his administration.
Women's health and LGBT rights must be a priority. They're not a bargaining chip. They're not something to be deprioritized and negotiated away.
That's Slutwalk organizer Emily Brooks. She cited issues that affect D.C., such as the federal budget rider that prevents the district from using its own tax dollars to subsidize abortions for low-income women. She also says local police have a history of mishandling crimes against the LGBT community. Just weeks ago, five lesbian women were attacked in the Columbia Heights neighborhood, and police not only refused to file a report, they threatened to arrest the victims. Brooks says stories like this show the importance of the Slutwalk's message.
No matter what you're wearing, what your sexuality is, what your immigration status is, what your race is, what your poverty level is, what your incarceration status is, I mean, none of that stuff matters. What matters is everyone deserves equal rights and deserves access to be walking around on the street, for God's sakes, you know? And any type of sexual assault is fully the responsibility of the attacker and has nothing to do with any type of the identity of the person who's attacked. It's completely irrelevant.
Dressed in everything from business suits to bikinis, the crowd marched to the foot of the Washington Monument, where speakers touched on political and personal issues.
When something horrible happens to one of us, something horrible has happened to all of us.
LGBT rights activist Charles Butler says the message of Slutwalk resonates with his community's campaign for respect and equality.
Blaming the victim happens in hate crimes. It happens in all kinds of anti-LGBT violence. And we definitely wanted to represent here and show solidarity with the women's rights movement.
Butler and other activists also called on Congress to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, pass workplace protections for LGBT people, and properly report and prosecute hate crimes. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The United States has large natural gas reserves, and the fuel also happens to be relatively clean burning. That's helped a natural gas development boom in recent years, but some who live near energy development have suffered, so much so that they filed a lawsuit against the industry. As FSRN's Conrad Wilson discovered, a number of those that live near natural gas production have been driven from their homes.
Karen Trulove is back in her old neighborhood in western Colorado. These green rolling hills, butting up against the snow-covered Rockies, used to be ranching and coal mining country. Now retirees and folks escaping city life live in small towns and developments where horses and cattle graze. But scattered across this valley are the reasons Truelove says she was forced to leave. Natural gas drilling rigs, which look a lot like city construction sites. And the finish wells remain visible, too, consisting of a tank about the size of a small car and a bunch of pipes sticking out of the ground. Truelove says the fumes from these wells made her sick.
There were many times when just after you smelled the fumes that day or the next day, you would be so lethargic that you could sit in a chair for 6 hours and not move a muscle.
Eventually, she moved. Nearby, Bill Strudley abandoned his 3,500-square-foot home after he says his family got sick.
I'd walk out into my driveway at 5:30 in the morning, and my wife would follow me, and I said, you better keep the kids inside today because it stinks.
Strudley says his well water eventually started to smell like chemicals, so the family stopped using it.
We had plastic duct tape to the inside windows of our house so the air couldn't come in.
Today, his house sits vacant. They've stopped paying their mortgage and rent in a nearby town where natural gas development hasn't hit yet. Stories like these are increasingly common as companies have started discovering a lot more gas, sometimes where people already live. A few miles down the road from the Strudley's old home, a large rig drills new wells. The gas is owned by Encana, one of the many operators in the area.
The health impact issue is one that is challenging because you have to find a causal link.
That's Doug Hawk, a spokesperson with the company. He acknowledges that drilling for natural gas is an industrial process that creates pollution. But he says the industry has come a long way in how it interacts with the community to minimize environmental impacts. For example, they've helped develop a hotline for residents to call and report their concerns, including ones about public health.
We're an industry of scientists and engineers, and we have to make our decisions based on sound science. And so, you know, we get people saying, well, I think this well is making me sick. But unless we have that link, you know, it's hard for us to react or respond to that.
But in a state where energy companies often own the rights to gas and other minerals beneath people's houses, the dialogue can appear rigged to residents. It's never about whether a company drills, only about how.
The typical conversation begins with an expression of immense frustration.
Corey Zerbaugh is an attorney in Aspen. He says he gets calls daily from people affected by natural gas development. His firm filed a class action lawsuit in July that wants gas driller Antero Resources to pay for environmental testing and set up a trust fund to help people should they get sick from natural gas development.
We are bringing this nationwide. That is our plan. Now, this is not a localized event. The drilling operations are going on in many states around the country, and we're seeing the same problems over and over again.
Standing outside her old house, Karen Truelove says the impacts she's experienced speak for themselves.
What we went through here was just kind of like being in a war zone. It was really like we weren't in Colorado anymore. It was like we weren't in the United States anymore because the effects of it were so extensive and we couldn't believe that no one really cared about us.
There's about a half dozen plaintiffs listed on the class action lawsuit, but it's filed on behalf of thousands of residents throughout the region. Conrad Wilson, FSRN, Carbondale, Colorado.
And thanks to FSRN for bringing us all that. If you'd like to keep up to date with their worthy newscasts and reports, you can find it at fsrn.org. I'm Martin Lemelin. You're listening to News 101. We're going to take a quick break. Coming back, we're going to take a look at your hopes for curbing your student debt in this coming year.
Sexual Assault Support Center offers support services to survivors of sexual assault and other forms of violence, as well as their friends, family members, and partners. They are committed to education and the support of students, staff, faculty, and visitors of all genders. They offer counseling, accompaniments, information, and referrals. They also facilitate specialized workshops and training sessions, develop public education campaigns, and hold special events related to anti-violence work. All services are free and confidential. For more information on programs and services or on volunteer opportunities, visit their website, www.ams.ubc.ca/sasc.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot? A salute?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
And welcome back to News 101. I am Martin Lemelin. That was a nice little promotion for Robert Privet's show, Sore Throats, Clapping Hands, coming up right after us here in just over 35 minutes. I'm sure he's got something good lined up. In the meantime, though, I was fortunate enough to have a chance to speak with Michelle Mungall, who is the MLA for Nelson and Creston. She's also the opposition critic for Advanced Education. And she brought a pretty harsh critique of BC's Advanced Education Minister for sort of turning a blind eye to student debt, and even going so far as to saying that it's a good thing that we carry so much debt. So here's the conversation I had with her. Well, Michelle, thank you very much for speaking to us. We'll start things off. Now, there are obvious concerns surrounding student debt. Now, when BC's Advanced Education Minister, Naomi Yamamoto, was pressed about these issues, how did she respond?
Well, what I've heard so far in getting feedback from student unions about their meetings with the Advanced Education Minister, Naomi Yamamoto, they're saying that they show her around the campus, they tell her about student poverty and what some students are going through just to make ends meet so they can continue going to schools, and they talk about student debt. And we have one of the highest debt loads in the entire country here in British Columbia on average. And her response, and it's the same response she gave to me in the budget estimates process, fortunate, and that student debt is a good debt to assume.
How is debt a good thing to have?
I have no idea what she means when she says that. It is absolutely ludicrous. And I think it really shows the extent to which she and her party are just completely out of touch with what's going on with students these days.
So the average debt load that we're carrying is about $27,000 for a four-year term?
That's right.
And how bad has it gotten over the past few years? Like, what was it, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago?
That's a really good question. I don't have that number off the top of my head, but tuition has been doubled since Christy Clark was a student at SFU, and the majority of that happened when the Liberals deregulated tuition in 2001. It went up by about 30%, and it's been going up steadily since then as well. That's one of the biggest reasons why student debt has gone up. But another big reason why student debt is as high as it is in BC, you got to think about the interest that students are going to pay. So they get out of school, they got a $27,000 debt on average. Well, we have the highest interest rate in the entire country on student loans here in British Columbia at prime plus 2.5%, and there's no reason for that.
Those who are most financially disadvantaged have to bear the grunt of the burden, don't they?
Absolutely. So if you can't afford to pay tuition up front, like most people, then you have to take on a debt and then also pay an extremely high interest rate. What's interesting is when I pressed the minister in the budget estimates process on how much do they borrow at for student loans before they lend it out to students, and what the government is borrowing out, what they told me, was prime minus one. So they're jacking up the price that their loan of those loans on students.
And have they given a reason that's like some kind of a reasoning for this?
Well, what they say is, at first, what the minister said was that those loans are the money that they get on top of what they have to repay the banks themselves. they put into student grants. Well, that's not true, because BC has absolutely zero financial needs-based grants for students in this province. So that's clearly not true. And then they backtracked on that and said, well, the, you know, it's the expense of the entire program. So basically what they're asking low-income students to do who have to get a loan is to pay off the cost of the program as well as defaults of other low-income students. And that's not how you manage a post-secondary education system that's supposed to be for the public good and for the good of our economy.
So not only so the high interest there rates are there for the financially disadvantaged, and they have to piggyback for those who are also taking on more debt that they can handle.
That's correct. And to me, that's just unethical and inappropriate. And it totally ignores the fact that post-secondary education is an investment in our assets in this province. And our best assets are our young people.
And we have no financial student grants right now?
No, we have zero student grants that are given out on a financial needs base. We have a few. We have a total of 7 grants. The majority of those are for people with disabilities, and those are good. We need to keep those grants. However, we also need to have grants that target particular programs that we really need to develop in this province to meet the economy of tomorrow. And we also need to make sure that we have financial needs based grants so that people who are of a low-income family are not unable. We did. In the 1990s, we had exceptional rate of financial needs-based grants. The BC Liberals cut a lot of that in 2001, but the big cuts came in the last 6 years, where every year they've been pulling more and more money out of the grant system.
And when you said that tuition was deregulated, that basically just gave universities free rein to charge what they wanted, right?
Yeah, and this, you have to keep in mind that universities have to meet their expenses, right, so that they can provide the programs that students want and what they're there for. And when the provincial government steps back from its role in funding to the extent that is needed to deliver those programs, the universities have no other place to go to than students.
What does the advanced education minister actually do? Like, what's her job description? What ought she be doing right now?
Well, she manages the Ministry of Advanced Education, right? So that's the relationship between the provincial government and the post-secondary institutions. It also involves long-term planning and financial management of how the province distributes funding to post-secondary institutions and how we manage that and how we manage spaces and so on.
And what could we be doing right now to curb student debt?
I think the biggest thing that we can do is put money into needs-based grants, right? If students have money just so that they can enter into post-secondary education, we're solving a big problem right there. And one of the things that Adrian Dix, myself, and the rest of the NDP want to do is put $100 million into needs-based grants in this province.
The 7 grants that you mentioned earlier, is that one grant for one individual per year, or is that one grant can cover several people?
So of the there's 7 granting programs, right? And how individuals apply to them is it depends on eligibility and so on. But the vast majority of those 7 grants are targeted for students with disabilities and to help them with their meet their learning goals and with the technologies and so on that they need to access so that they can meet their full potential. And those are good grants. You know, we agree with those grants, and we're glad that those have not been cut by the BC Liberals. So we want to keep those grants, but it's not good enough. We need to go further. We need to look at this from a bigger picture, and we need those financial needs-based grants, and we want to see $100 million go back into them.
From a student perspective, what is the best thing that we could do to maybe help change the system and make it better for us?
Vote. Get get out and vote. Make sure you're registered to vote. It's really simple. People can go online to theelectionsbc.ca and they can register to vote right there. It takes less than a minute to do. And look on your campus and in campuses all over the province. This September, there will hopefully be some voter registration tables put on by students' unions and student clubs. And go to them and register to vote. And when it's election time, get out to vote.
Well, thanks a lot for speaking to me, Michelle. Is there anything that I may have missed you think is important to know?
Well, I would also add that one of the ways that we can really help curb debt is also with those interest rates, is that the longer you hold that debt, the more you're actually paying back because of... What we want to do in the NDP is eliminate interest rates on student loans, and that will have a huge impact on students once they graduate and the type of income they'll be and where they their disposable income and what they can put that money towards.
And it's something that the government actually has control of whether they could be lowered and heightened, right?
Absolutely.
So it's that other provinces are carrying?
Well, Newfoundland has a 0% interest rate on student loans, and that has done a really good job for their economy. They'll do the same thing. Former Prime Minister Paul Martin was on the radio the other day saying exactly that, is that in times like these, education is a cornerstone.
Speaking to us, Michelle. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
All right. Take care, Martin. Bye-bye.
Michelle.
Screening of award-winning documentary The Cove with an introduction and discussion with Leah Lemieux, author of Rekindling the Waters, The Truth About Swimming with Dolphins. It's all taking place at SFU Harbor Center, 515 West Hastings.
But the deal was made official today. Other announcements included Glenn Davidson, who will be serving as the ambassador to Afghanistan. Now, Davidson used to be the commander of the Maritime Forces at Kabul from William Crosby, who offered to resign after criticisms he made about Afghan President Hamid Karzai were published by WikiLeaks. Also, Alicia Goldberg also made the cut, serving as Canada's new ambassador to the UN. Goldberg was our very first representative in Kandahar, a post that was created by the Tories in 2008 in an effort to coordinate defense, diplomacy, and development efforts in Afghanistan. And finally, Sanjeev Chowdhury, who was part of the team that put together the G8 and G20 summits last year, he's now going to be serving as Canada's Consul General in Rio de Janeiro. Just as a little side note, pretty much all of our defense teams are going to be changing names tomorrow. Both Army, Air Force, and Navy. They used to be known as the Maritime Command and Air Command. They're going back to the Royal Canadian Navy and Army and Air Force tomorrow, just to go back to some, I'm not sure what the reasoning is, but all the same, it's going back to simpler times. Also, police have confirmed that the victims of a shooting which took place in broad daylight outside Kelowna's Delta Grand Hotel yesterday was, in fact, Jonathan Bacon. Jonathan is the eldest of three brothers who are believed to control the Red Scorpions gang, who are at the heart of what is being called a gang war in Metro Vancouver nearly 3 years ago. Now, according to eyewitnesses, a masked gunman with an assault rifle was seen exiting a green SUV, then walked up the sidewalk, shooting at a Porsche Cayenne. In addition to Jonathan Bacon, a full-patched Hell's Angel was killed in the attack, which is prompting residents to worry for their safety in anticipation for a retaliatory attack. Now, police are now sifting through evidence trying to devise how many were in the green SUV, who they were, and, if possible, who they were connected with. So far, Jonathan's two brothers, Jamie and Jared, are in jail serving time for unrelated crimes. We're now going to take a look at our weekday weather forecast. Get away from some of that grim news, and it's looking pretty good. Tonight, it's going to go down to a low of 11 degrees. We're going to see a few clouds, but a mostly clear night. Tomorrow, mainly sunny, a high of 21. Barely a cloud in the sky. Same for Wednesday, high of 22. Very few clouds. Wednesday, we're going to see a mix of sun and clouds. Low of 12, high of 21. Still no rain. Friday, it's going to start getting overcast, cloudy. It's still about 22 degrees. And Saturday, partial cloudy. High of 24, low of 14. Sunday, we might see some rain, but that is still a far way away. That is your weekday weather forecast. Information has been brought to you by the fine folk of Environment Canada. Take another little break here. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
These days, you have to watch your back. Danger may be lurking where you least expect it. You may find a relative, friend, or neighbor coming after one thing, your brain.
The Rio Theatre presents the second annual Dead On Film Zombie Short Film Competition, Friday, August 19th. After receiving an enormous number of submissions stacked higher than a pile of fresh corpses, the Rio has whittled down a list of the top 10 contenders for your screening pleasure. You, the audience, will vote for Best Picture.
Dad, you killed the zombie Flanders!
He was a zombie?
The Dead On Film Zombie Short Film Competition, Friday, August 19th at the Rio Theatre. Visit riotheatre.ca to learn more.
Remember, zombies don't eat candy, only brains.
Yep, zombies sure don't. Welcome back to News 101. My name is Martin Lemelin. We are now going to go things over south of the border again to FSRN, who did a nice little report on a former Egyptian president who is being brought to court.
Former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak returned to a Cairo courtroom today to face charges that he conspired to kill protesters and engaged in corruption. Today's proceedings only lasted for a couple of hours and included a recess. Defense lawyers requested more time to review documents, and a judge banned future TV broadcasts of the trial and adjourned the proceedings until September 5th. But while Mubarak and members of his regime are slowly being tried in the civil justice system, many civilian protesters are being tried in military courts, including activist and blogger Asma Mahfouz, who was charged yesterday with insulting and inciting violence against Egypt's ruling generals. For more, we go to FSRN's David Enders, who's in Cairo. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's the reaction on the streets of Cairo to this decision to adjourn the Mubarak trial?
Well, I don't think anyone is particularly surprised. The first two trial dates were more than 10 days apart. It's also Ramadan, so that'll put it after the holiday at the end of Ramadan. So I don't think the adjournment is so much a surprise. I think there was a little more reaction to not showing the trial on TV, as they've done with the last two hearings.
So how did the judge justify that decision not to show the trial on television?
This is in line with Egyptian law, and obviously there are not very many courthouses in the U.S. where cameras are allowed in. It was to keep witnesses from hearing one of his testimony was the actual reason for that.
Can you give us a sense of how Egyptians have reacted to this decision?
Yeah, sure. It's a number of the lawyers applauding the judge's decision. So I think within the Egyptian legal community, there's support and precedent for that. People are certainly worried that the proceedings will not be transparent, although reporters apparently will still be let into the courtroom to cover the proceedings. So there certainly will still be, I think, whatever level of transparency is possible in a trial like this.
There have been crowds of protesters and clashes outside the courtroom. Can you tell us who these different groups who've gathered outside the courtroom are and what do they want out of this trial?
The scene outside the courtroom, it's very emotional. And I think maybe it's more tagged to emotions than politics, in a sense. The two groups, during both hearings outside the courtroom, have attacked each other with rocks and fists. And the riot police, actually, on the hearing on the 3rd, were pushing journalists away out of the way so that they could get out of where the rocks were being thrown. And certainly some of the journalists today were wearing helmets. One journalist on the 3rd complained of being attacked. And apparently it's happened to a few others. So it is a very emotional crowd. It's a very small crowd, numbering a few hundred people. It's almost more like a football match sort of atmosphere. It's kind of like they cheer when something seems good for their side.
What sort of access have prosecution lawyers had to Mubarak's official documents and records?
There have been orders a review of documents that lawyers have requested, such as ministry and police files, be conducted. It remains to be seen whether or not that will be done or fruitful or thorough.
The judge also still has to rule on who will actually testify in court, and Mubarak's lawyers have asked the judge to call more than 1,500 witnesses. Why have those defence lawyers called so many witnesses, and do we have an idea of who any of those witnesses are yet?
Well, the defence is requested to call witnesses ranging from police officers to Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, who is the head of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces and essentially the leader of Egypt since Mubarak stepped down. I think perhaps calling 1,500 witnesses is more of a defence tactic. But there have been formal requests for high-level people in the government to testify.
Mubarak and members of his regime are being tried in civilian courts, but Egypt's military rulers have been using military courts for civilians. And on Sunday, a prominent female blogger and activist, Asma Mahfouz, was charged with slandering and inciting violence against the country's governing generals. Can you tell us a little bit more about her case and how Egyptians are reacting to that?
She's out on bail. She was forced to pay a $3,500 bail. And amongst people, in that community of activists, there's great outrage toward these military trials and specifically towards the trials of activists. There are many more going on. There are people who have received multiple year sentences already and are serving time. There have been more than 12,000 arrests by the military since March. Although the opposition to this is not as loud as say, the opposition to Mubarak that we've seen 6 months ago.
What's the situation on the streets of Cairo generally, and is life returning to some sort of normality now?
The riot police have been pretty quick to disperse any sort of gathering in Tahrir Square since they took down the tent camp that had been there for a month on August 3rd. There are very small demonstrations. Since the Tahrir protest, there haven't been any major actions that have, you know, shut down a square that large or caused quite as much of a stir. And gatherings in Tahrir over the last week have been broken up very quickly and forcibly by the riot police.
David Enders in Cairo, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And thanks to FSRN for that. We're now back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. I have this... the leader of the arts report, Adam Yanuz, was fortunate enough to attend the Shambhala Music Festival a couple of weekends ago. And being the capable reporter that he is, he always had his microphone at the ready for a prospective interview. He brought back a really good one with one of the ladies who was tending the harm reduction tents, where the attendees of the festival could bring drugs that they'd bought and have them tested for impurities, not necessarily impurities, but garbage that they've put in there. So Adam spoke to this woman and found out exactly what they're testing for and who they're doing it for. So we're going to have a quick little listen there.
So in our testing, we have come across a lot of unknowns this year, or inconclusive. So yeah. To remind our audience, what we can test for is, it's not a purity test, it's a reagent test. So we can test for the existence of MDMA, and if there's no MDMA, we can, or MDMA-like substance, we can test for ketamine speed, 2CT group, like 2CT7, 2CI, 2CB, DXM, did I say ketamine? Anyways, yes. We can test for those.
Yeah.
And we can't test for purity, we can't test for anything else.
Right.
So if those substances don't show up, what we can say to people is, you thought you were buying ecstasy, it's not testing for anything we can test for, we recommend you don't take it.
Right.
So what's happening a lot this year is stuff is showing up with very trace amounts or nothing at all.
Right.
And so people are feeling like the tests aren't working, but in actual fact, it could be piperazines. It could be a psychostimulant that doesn't show up on our radar, like Foxy. Or it could be garbage, which I suspect it's a lot of garbage.
And why would it be garbage? Why would dealers sell? Why would they do such a thing?
Well, despite that every dealer sells really pure shit.
Right. Mine's the purest
so
on the market.
So pure. It's pure MDMA. It's a capitalist industry, right?
Yeah.
And Shambhala is very much a capitalist industry. People are here to make money. And so pressed pills in general tend to be less pure than caps, because by merit of being a pressed pill, it has binder in it.
Yeah.
And then it's just so easy and tempting to put more stuff in. And so at least about 38% of what we test is not what we test it for,
right?
So it's a, you know, people want to make money, and I think people are like making crap and selling it.
And then just speak a little bit more broadly, how does this year compare to last year? Are there more overdoses? Are there less? Are they being more responsible, less responsible? What's your take?
Well, actually, it's been a really great year, in my opinion, and I think in First Aid's opinions at Shambhala. Less overdoses. Woohoo! So it feels a lot more chill, and it feels like... by Thursday and Friday last year, there had been something like 15 or 20 GHB overdoses, like 8 intubations, people being rushed to the hospital. And I think we've had, you know, 4 or 5 GHB overdoses. So GHB is our number one overdoser.
Right.
Now ketamine is climbing up there.
Ketamine is climbing. So ketamine is becoming more popular. It's becoming more like the one that everybody's doing.
Yeah, like even in the past 3 years, it was always ecstasy that everyone was doing.
Yeah.
And now it's like different. Everyone's wanting to mix now ecstasy and ketamine together, which is a bit terrifying.
Why is that terrifying?
Ecstasy is an upper, right? It has meth or speed cut into it. And ketamine is a disassociative, it's a downer, and so that's pretty confusing for your body.
Right, for your hearts. And
just one of the deals at Shambhala is people just mix. They just mix like crazy, and so people lose track of how they feel. They lose track of their grounding with their body, and so...
Right, so whereas before on E, they could at least maybe a little bit more... feel like, okay, I've danced for an hour and a half straight without 15 hours without water, maybe I should have a seat and have a breather. With ketamine, they're a little bit dissociated from their bodies and don't feel how they're feeling.
At a low dose, ketamine is kind of hallucinogen and it's trippy and fun and light, and people can still dance and have a good time. At a higher dose, as I'm sure you know, people will slip into a K-hole.
Yeah.
So the K-hole isn't the biggest party situation, right?
I don't think that makes for light feet on the dance floor.
It's a surprising festival drug, but there is lots of K-holing, and so and of course this year people are starting to mix alcohol with ketamine, or mix GHB, or mix oxys with ketamine, or that kind of use, and so it's just really sketchy, because up plus down is dangerous, but down plus down is dangerous. So
right. And with ketamine, what is the risk? I think there's a general impression out there that it's like a veterinary drug, so it's sort of more you scoff at that.
So ketamine is used in dentistry. It's used in medicine. It's used in vet medicine. But the thing that people should hold is especially at a festival like this, ketamine is going to be coming from Vancouver, from Calgary, and en route, it's got 8 hours each way, right? It's going to get cut. It's going to get cut. Again, it's a business. So most ketamine is buffed, so that's something to keep in mind.
Is what?
Buffed. That's one of our terms. It means it's cut with something. You want to be careful, because if you're taking high doses, you don't know what else you're taking, right? And buffing agents can be dewormer, can be, you know, it can be pretty much
anything
any
under
white
the sun.
Powder, and you want to be careful with that.
And what about putting things in your nose? There's risks there too, no?
Sure, sure. And then I think the other thing is that, ketamine is injected, it's snorted, and occasionally taken orally, but it is very psychologically addictive, it is. For the people it works for, they really dig the K-hole, and it can be psychologically addictive. And
you say psychologically versus, biologically, or?
Well, in addictions, there's kind of a couple different understandings, like heroin or an opiate, right? You will get physically ill, where you get dope sick when you're coming down from the drug and you need more drug. Ketamine, you're not going to get physically ill, but your mind is going to want it.
Yeah, you're going to miss the happy vibes that you had.
Or the escape, or the no body, or whatever right. It is that works for you, right? And that's not all people. Not all people dig the K-hole even. It's just a concern here because, some of the risks with ketamine is that you can barf, right? So if you're K-holing and you're folded in half or you're lying down and you don't have a sitter, it's a really good idea to have a sitter when you're K-holing. You could throw up and you can breathe that in or swallow it and choke on it. So that's a big risk. And then just down plus down is dangerous. And what we're seeing here is people will do acid and ecstasy for, you know, like 12 hours, and then they'll start hitting K, and it's just a lot for the body.
Right. It's a big stress.
Yeah.
Let's back up a little and talk about harm reduction. Would you agree that Shambhala's got a really good harm reduction, teamwork of the, you know, pill testing, first aid? There's also a new thing this year, the women's...
The sexual assault team?
Sexual assault team. Tell us about that.
The women's safe space. Yeah. Well, I think at Shambhala we actually get to see harm reduction happen, which is awesome. I think it's what... let me be careful with my words here. I think that Shambhala was a small festival that grew very big, and in suddenly growing to a small city size, right, of 14,000 people, it changed. And now I think Shambhala is really trying to bring it back to more art and more artistic creation, and and a little less away from the mythology of, like, woohoo, party, party, party.
Party, party, yeah.
Yeah, drugs.
Right.
And... the reality is drugs are done here, and a lot of drugs are done here. And so what is fantastic about the harm reduction team at Shambhala is we kind of joke and call it Fourage instead of Triage, is we have the sanctuary, which does psychedelic counseling safe space for people. So if you're wigging out or having a bad reaction to your drugs, you can go there, and there's people to counsel you and talk you through it. There's an amazing first aid team, and like, it's really just like a field hospital, right? Like the fact that people are intubating out here, it's just madness.
Yeah.
We have our pill testing and condoms and, you know, talking about dosage and overdosage and mixing at the anchor's tent. And then this year we have a women's only sexual assault safe space team. And it's been a quiet year for them so far, but it's a really positive move to have it. Sexual assault is a hidden, quiet reality of festivals like Shambhala, and each year is different for sexual assault, but it's a very terrible reality that exists, and so it's great that is up and running.
And thanks a lot for that, Adam. I hope you don't mind my shameless pilfering of your intellectual property, but there it is. I'm going to take a very quick break and stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. broadcasting right here at UBC in Vancouver.
Looking for something to do this Saturday? The Muse Art Cultural Society is pleased to announce the return of the Cates Park Concert Series, showcasing 27 local bands and artists Saturdays from 4 to 7 p.m. between July 16th and August 27th. Come on down and see fabulous up-and-coming talent, and be sure to pick up the compilation CD featuring every artist in the concert series. The money goes right back to the musicians. To learn more about the Cates Park Concert Series and the Muse Art Cultural Society, visit museart.ca. In the meantime, head down to Cates Park Saturdays from 4 to 7 p.m. and let the music do the rest.
And that's pretty much just about going to do it for our show on today, August 15th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please don't hesitate to contact us. You can phone us at 604-822-5334, or you can email us, news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter under the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us here Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin, and from the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. with Robert, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.